Yeah, so we can always hope. We'll call the meeting of legislative management to order, and Mr. Smith will take the role.
Representatives Carlson.
Here.
Damshin.
Here.
Drubdahl.
Here.
Kelsch. Meyer.
Here.
Onstead.
Here.
Ruby.
Here.
Bigassa.
Here.
Wise. Senators Urbley.
Here.
Heckman.
Here.
Hoag.
Here.
Holmberg. Lee. Robinson.
Aye.
Taylor. Wardner.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman, you have a quorum.
You received a copy of the...
Minutes from the last meeting. If there's no changes, we'll take a motion to approve. We have a motion by Senator Robinson, a second by Representative Bigassa. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. Before we start with the first presentation, you have in your in your packet, it says comments by Representative Carlson to the management. And I'm going to have, this basically deals with the statutory requirements that we have for this meeting for why we look at these issues. And Mr. Buringer will just kind of give us a brief summary of that, that memo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the legislative management. There's a Century Code section 16.10117, which provides that at least 90 days before any statewide election at which an initiated measure will be voted on, the legislative council is to coordinate determination of estimated fiscal impact. Upon notification by the Secretary of State that initiative petitions are have been submitted for placement of an initiated measure on the ballot, the legislative management is to hold hearings to determine the fiscal impact of that measure. This was accomplished for measure number two with respect to the property tax reform by the legislative management creating the property tax measure review committee. And that's the committee that has held public hearings, it's received public testimony, and it's gathered information on the fiscal impact of measure number two. So for, with respect to the statutory requirements, that committee has met the requirements for the legislative management to receive public hearing and public testimony on that. There's another initiated measure, and that's measure number three. There has been no legislative management committee to hold hearings on that. So today, there's the opportunity for receiving any public testimony as to the fiscal impact of that measure. And once the legislative management receives this information, a report is submitted to the Secretary of State as to the fiscal impact of initiated measures number two and number three. And Mr. Chairman, that's the statutory requirements and as to why the legislative management is required to meet today to receive information on the initiated measures.
And this does not end up on the ballot. Where it does end up is if you went to the Secretary, I believe I'm correct in that, to his website, you would see what we pass out of here today as the fiscal effect of that measure. So someone is going to have to go look for that. The reason this came about, and I was part of that reason, was if you remember the youth initiative years ago, there was about seven different sets of numbers, and everybody had a different number as to what the fiscal effect would be. And the voters ended up being the one trying to figure out which one was really right. So we figured it would be smart if we went to the appropriate people and got the numbers as to what the fiscal effect would be, make sure that if they want a site they can go to, that they can get that particular information. This is not, I think probably the second to last paragraph is that was probably the most important. This is not a hearing. We're going to get a report from Representative Drubdahl and his committee that we established to review this. And then we're going to have some discussion, and then we will vote on whether or not, well, what information we're going to move forward on the fiscal effect. Representative Drubdahl, with that, we'll, you can either stay in your chair and go from there, or you can go to the podium. Your choice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I always love to be at a podium, so I'll start up here. I appreciate all of you coming to this meeting I called for your sake. The Property Tax Measure Review Committee has met a number of times and asked a lot of questions. Our duty was basically to come up with a fiscal note, the impact to the state of North Dakota, and the impact to the political subdivisions. In order to do that, of course, we needed to understand the effects of the Measure 2 would have on the people of North Dakota, the state of North Dakota, and its political subdivisions. The, as you all know, property tax is a tax that's put on by political subdivisions with the exception of one mill that goes to the University of North Dakota. It is a primary source of funding for this political subdivisions, including towns, townships, cities, schools, and counties. To determine property tax, and I'll just briefly review this because you're all fully aware of it, that the local assessor determines the true and full value based on the value, the market value of the property. In the case of a residential property, they take that times 50%, and then they take a factor of 9% to come up with assessed value. In regard to commercial value, they use the same technique, take it times 50%, but then take it times 10% to come up with assessed value. And in regard to agricultural property across, it's calculated by the North Dakota State University by production and capitalization averages, and then taken times 50% and then times 10% to come up with the value. So it's not based on market value as are the other two. There are other taxes involved in lieu of taxes, and I will get into them a little bit later. Some of the in lieu of taxes was determined that they will be eliminated as because they are based on the value. Some in lieu of taxes are not based on value and therefore would remain in place. Indebtedness was a subject that we spent a lot of time on. There is the counties and cities have the ability and a number of different ways to bond. Those bonds many times are guaranteed by mill levies. By the Constitution, those mill levies are contract agreement between the bondholder and the political subdivisions, and those would stay in place until those bonds were paid off, 10, 20 years, whatever it is, and then those mill levies would not be able to be reassessed again unless the legislature did some reauthorization. But with property tax gone, the ability to bond using revenues as a back, financial backing of it would be pretty well, it wouldn't be eliminated. But what we were told as a committee by one of the bond experts was that who's going to buy your bond if there's no guaranteed revenue behind it? And what interest rate would you have to pay for that bond if you didn't have a guaranteed source of funding? So they felt that the bonding probably would be quite different than it is today as a tool for the subdivisions. Tax increment financing bonds, they would be available, but they're based on property tax, and there would not be property tax, so therefore tax increment financing would no longer be available as a development tool for improving slums and blighted areas in cities and counties. Existing tax increment financing was a little bit shy, in the gray area, because if it's based on if the mill levies, if it's a contract agreement between the bondholders that provided the funding for tax increment financing and the subdivisions, then it would most likely continue the same as gold bonds or levies, special levies. If it was not in writing as a contract agreement and part of the obligation that the city was paying, then of course it would be included in the current property tax that the state is to fund back, and the state would be paying for the tax increments financing. Generally, going into the measure two, it eliminates property tax. That's what the bill does, with two exceptions. One is special assessments and one is special levies. And the one is for bonding. The other is not based on the assessed value, but it's based on the just proportion to the total cost of such work to the property that it touches. So let's say, I'll try to have an example of sidewalk. They put in a sidewalk, they'll assess the property owner the length of his property for the value of that sidewalk. If he has a 50-foot property, he'd pay one. If he had a 100-foot property, he'd pay another figure. But it wouldn't be assessed on the value of the building on that land. That would be continued, and that would be a tool that'd still be available to political subdivisions. Special assessments for bonds, special levies for bonds, are not available to schools anymore, because the only way they can get revenue is through mill levies, and they would have no ability to do that whatsoever. Cities, it's still questionable if they could come up with additional funding source.
Can you explain that one more time again so I understand on the schools?
The only way schools can fund is through property tax. They don't have any other revenue source.
How about the buildings at school?
Well, that's based on property tax too, special levies for property tax.
There'd be no school buildings allowed unless they came to us and asked us if they could build schools.
That was an interpretation we had, because where would they have the money to get, where would they have the revenue to guarantee a bond? They would have to come and ask us for a guaranteed revenue.
So I understand that. Thank you.
The cities, on the other hand, would have some alternative method to collect some additional revenue. It would basically be by going to home rule and having a city sales tax. Schools, of course, cannot have home rule and cannot have a sales tax. The property tax in lieu of that would be continued include the oil and gas production tax, the oil extraction tax, coal severance tax, coal conversion tax. But before I go beyond, the committee was informed that the coal severance and conversion tax was paid under protest. So we consider that probably a legal challenge down the road. Potash tax would still be in place. Tourist fees, it would stay in place. Electric generating, distribution, and transmission taxes would stay in place. Telecommunication taxes and a financial institution tax. What was pointed out to us, we left the electric generator, distribution, and transmission lines. That's the way North Dakota has treated the rural electrics in order to get the revenue to pay for the expenses involved with the services provided to them. On the other hand, public utilities, like particularly like MDU, pays a property tax, and of course that would be eliminated. Taxes that would no longer, in lieu of taxes that would no longer be on the books, would be the farmland and ranch land owned by non-profit corporations, organizations, and conservation purposes. Game and fish lands would no longer be on the National Guard, land owned by the Board of Universities, school lands, or state treasurer. Carbon dioxide pipelines would no longer have a in lieu of tax. The Devil's Lake project land would no longer have a tax, and the workforce safety insurance building would no longer have a tax. One other thing that was pointed out on the property tax, we have some, not a lot, but we have some agricultural land out there that is covered entirely with wood, has no production value, and we have a law in the books called a tree tax, where the owner of that land can go to the county commissioners and agree to pay a reduced fee, a tree fee, for that parcel of land in lieu of the property tax. That tax stays in place because it's not based on value, but the property tax that landowner would have paid is gone. So it kind of goes opposite of what we use. The revenue that we had to base our forecast on, the measure said the revenue used, not necessarily levied to the taxpayers of North Dakota in property tax. It's what they spent of the property tax. I don't know if we could really determine exactly what they spent by not, because we couldn't go through every item, every budget. I think the estimate is going to be based on what they actually collected in property tax, but it's supposed to be on what they used. And it's based on the 2011 calendar, what they collected in property tax in 2011. There is a couple of other terms that cause us a lot of concern. We know what they collected in 2011. The measure goes on to say that the state is supposed to refund, assembly is to allocate shares of state taxes to fully and properly fund the legally imposed obligations. There is no definition in the measure or anywhere else to say what fully and proper funding is. There also is no definition of what a legally imposed obligation is. Those are two things that the legislature are going to have to determine. And the question came up, if we went through the audit of all the 300 or 400 political subdivisions, and we determined some of those items were not legally obligated obligations, can we cut down below the 2011 property tax level if we determine some of those are not what's legally obligated? That was a question that could not be answered. It appears that the base is going to be the 2011 and any additional funding above that. The market value of property, if the state legislature determines or finds a way to allow the subdivisions to borrow money to go into indebtedness, the measure does increase the amount of indebtedness that they they can go into. And it increases because it takes off the word taxable property, and it includes all property. And that would be read to mean not only real estate property, but personal property. And the assessors would then therefore have to also go out and infringe upon the citizens which we currently don't do, by determining the value of personal property, if that is to remain, and that is what the bill says. It's an enormous expansion of the assessment responsibility. There was testimony that brought forward to the committee on a study. We did not do an economic study. The committee that brought the measure before us did bring a study before us. It's called the Beacon Hill Institution Study, and it has some interesting things in it. I did advise the committee to read the study intensively, and I certainly asked that the legislative management members read that study too. It's a very interesting study, and I don't know it personally. I don't really disagree with anything they say in there. What the committee did say is, of course, that we would be responsible providing the funding after 2011 taxes are paid. School boards. It says the school board would have the sole discretion to determine expenditures in the new funding provided by the state. Now, the committee listened to that, and as we know, that the state is, the property tax is funding 25% to 30% of the school's current budget. So if we fund that 25% to 30% instead of them getting it from property tax, what new funding are they getting? We also pointed out that there's nothing in the measure saying that the other 56% or 60% that we fund has to remain where it currently is too. We only have to fund, which I don't see where we'd ever want to cut anything, but I mean, it doesn't say we have to continually fund at our current levels. It goes on, they went on to say, of course, and I mentioned earlier, fully and properly funding legal obligations. And it went on to say the political subdivisions would have the sole discretion to determine expenditures of funding provided by the state. That was pointed out to us too, and it does say that. We are providing their funding that they have already determined as their expenses based on 2011. So again, the committee was at loss of what new funding they would have the discretion of. It was what's in their budget, and if they took it out of the budget, then it would go into the legally imposed obligations. The Beacon Hill report, which a committee, which you hear a lot of quotes on in the newspaper, and which was reported, was a study done, and the basis of it was measured against the baseline economy. In other words, if there was another contributing factors such as the growth we've had in personal income and the growth we've had in oil and gas revenue, how would the measure affect the economy based on its own merit, the baseline economy? It had three different scenarios, and the one you hear the most is the one that, of course, would increase jobs by 11,789 private jobs, and it would, but it would decrease public jobs by 11,908. That is accomplished if the legislatures decide that they are going to cut state expenses and take that savings and pay out to the counties. That's the basis of the savings there. And if we cut state expenses, I think everybody agreed there would be more money in the private sector. The question is, can we cut them? The second scenario is if we replaced 50% of the property tax with other taxes. And there isn't, and the point being that there is no cost saving actually in the bill itself. But if we had to raise 50% sales tax, 50% of the money through, say, like sales tax, and we cut services 50%, then there would be a moderate gain in the economic value. These citizens in 2010, private sector jobs would be 2,591, but it would be at the cost of 8,551 public sector jobs. And I go back just a step. The first scenario, the 11,908 employee jobs of the state, that's about 40% of our workforce. So it's you know, you can draw your own conclusion. The third scenario, and is one that if we had to, if other conditions weren't contributing, if we didn't have the tremendous increase in income tax, the number of people living here, and oil revenue, gas revenue, and sales tax revenue, and we had to increase other taxes to cover the full cost of the property tax replacement, there would be a negative impact on the economy. It would be some loss of 10,862 jobs net between the private and public sector, and income would not go up as predicted, of course. Yeah, now, the conclusion, I do want to put the conclusion of the Beacon Hill study, and this is the second sentence in the first paragraph, and it's a full sentence. Should the state decide to compensate for the need to pay for the block grants by increasing the state sales tax, many of the private sector benefits would be tempered or become negative, and that's what I mean. There's really not a cost saving in the measure itself. Going on, we had testimony from the League of Cities, and of course they're concerned about a constant revenue Association of Counties, they're concerned about a constant revenue source. The League of Cities, we got testimony from them, they're pretty much the same. They did give us a chart, and you have the chart of what mill levies are currently being levied by the cities across North Dakota, the 357 different municipals. The School Boards Association brought in interesting information. As you are well aware of, is because of the last 10 years, North Dakota has been at the edge of a lawsuit. In fact, we were in a lawsuit that we won by losing 3-2 in equity in school funding. That equity in school funding was based on the value of property tax behind each student. If you eliminate property tax, you eliminate that equity figure. And their concern was it's going to have a significant impact on the funding formula currently in place for school districts and the potential result in inadequate distribution, especially if the only thing we have to base it on is per pupil. That is something that was a great concern to them, and I think it has been to many of the members of the committee. Other testimony again, we had people telling us that property tax are ineffective. Well, we know that because when we have recession, we continue to have bills trying to correct the inefficiency of property tax, but so there was no disagreement in that. North Dakota Century Code allows for a lien on property that they can take the property if you don't pay your property tax bill. Of course, there wouldn't be a property tax after 2012 for this year, but any previous property tax bills out there, if you don't pay them, you'd still be subject to losing your property for that payment. The initiated measure, we did ask Attorney General for opinions. He gave us two. First one, he said he can't really give an opinion until it becomes law. The second one he did give us was that it does go into effect January 1st of this year, which means that the taxes for 2011 are paid, but nobody is going to be assessed for the 6 months up to the date of the vote. There will be no property tax at all for this year. And it was recommended state, and there was testimony saying that state and local governments are not going to be able to eliminate the full-time equivalent positions in regard to property tax assessments, so because of the other obligations. The final note, the estimated fiscal impact of initiated measure number two, which we have to base on history, was $812,225,000 for 2012 alone. That's a one-year estimate. They did build into the average growth, which of course would be a determination of the legislature, but the way we do forecasting, they did put it in, and for the biennium of 2013 through 2015, the price tag will be $1.8 billion for the 2 years. The committee did discuss the potential need for a special session, and the reason is that the subdivisions are doing their budget. They need to know they have the money available January 15th when the first payroll comes up. They need to have the money. So the committee did discuss the need for it. I was asked after the meeting if, on a personal note, I'll say this, I was asked after the meeting if I felt that there would be a special session if it passes, and I respond as I do believe it would. I did receive an email from the committee that sponsored the bill demanding that I retract that, call the station and retract that statement, and I didn't retract that statement. I have no intention of doing that. With that, I'd be glad to answer any question. I do want to, as I showed at the beginning, I want to thank Becky Keller for all the work that she did for the committee in setting up, and Al Knutson for all the work that he did in helping us determine some of these questions and determine the proper answers to them and help fill out the report. With that, if I could answer any questions, I'd be happy to, or I know Alan's here, and I think, I'm not sure if Becky's here or not, but I hope so. But the tax department is here to respond to the fiscal note, if there's any questions on the fiscal note.
Just to go back, if there's any type of a tax that's based on the valuation of property, that would no longer be in existence. Is there an exception to that rule?
I think that's a pretty general statement to make. It.
Is that accurate or not? I mean, as I was listening, that's kind of what I garnered from it. If there was any type of a tax, property valuation to assess it, that would be removed. Okay, just so I understand. Senator Robinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Dervdahl, I believe I'm correct in saying that there's no other precedent, no other state that has gone down this road and eliminated all property taxes. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Robinson, there is no state that has completely eliminated property tax. We did hear of a county or two in Alaska and in England that the personal county did, and Alaska had to do with oil revenue that they had, but no state is without property tax across the board.
Any other questions? Yes. Representative Damshin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A comment and a question. Excuse me. I know that the out-of-state revenue from out-of-state landowners is included in the revenue report, but it is kind of a double whammy because that $120 million is absorbed by the people, residents of the state. Is it not? I mean, it shows up in that report, but it isn't noted that that's $120 million from out of state that's coming in that will have to be covered by the residents of North Dakota if this measure passes.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dabson, that is correct. It's about $126.3 million, I believe it is, that currently are collected from out of state owners of property in North Dakota. If there's no property tax, there would be no bill to those out of state residents, and that would be included in the $812 million that is being covered by the state to the local subdivisions. Correct.
I may continue. I know the discussion has been had, too, that they will make it up in sales tax and income tax, the out-of-state landowners. But are they not already paying North Dakota sales tax and income tax? So we're still out the property tax.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Damshin, reading the Beacon Hill study, they base that on growth because of the cut in the cost of state government by less eliminating, so maybe up to 40% of our workforce. If we did not eliminate that 40%, then there would be no increase in sales tax, according to that study.
Brings up my final question, if I may continue.
Continue.
Talking about the job positions that are eliminated, how many public employees are there? I thought there was some conflict in those numbers that we were eliminating more jobs than existed in that report, that 11,000.
We are limited, Mr. Chairman and Representative Damshin. I believe that when they quoted 40% of the workforce in North Dakota, they included all the colleges plus all the other workforce, and I don't recall an exact number, but if their number is correct, 40% of 12,000 would be 28,000 to 30,000 employees across the state. I don't know if anybody has the exact number, but we didn't really question that.
Thank you.
Representative Ruby and then Senator Wharton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Dervdahl, you know, the Beacon Hill, I did read it as well. I mean, isn't that just a suggestion of where the state, if they found money, if they eliminated a certain number of employees, that would equal that amount of dollars? But isn't that also, does it also allude to there are other areas of the state budget that could be cut to find those savings as well?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ruby, the study itself, and the committee was not authorized to do its own study, and we did not accept it as our study. I'm quoting it because it was it was part of the record that was given to us. It uses the employees as a way to show the budget cut, but that would be up to the legislature. They wouldn't necessarily have to do the 40%. I think it was just the easiest way to explain it.
Senator Warder.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dervdahl, the number 74.6 million, that's what's in the amount that we would need to replace per year?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Warner, the amount that we're replacing based on the 2011 for 1 year was $812,225,000 for 1 year.
Okay.
And with projected growth, they estimated that it'll be, for the biennium, for the 2 years that we generally budget by, it would be $1.8 billion.
Well, that's my question. Do we honor the $812 million per year? Or do we go with, if we wanted to, go with what's in the measure, $774.6 million? That's my question to you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Warner. The committee felt that the language of the bill, that we replace the revenue used, collected or spent during after 2011, was the 812, and that would be the figure that we're presenting to the Secretary of State.
Yes, Representative Onstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up that same idea, that you're using $1.8 billion, it would be the fiscal impact that we would replace that. And if the state was to fully fund what is currently there, and with that growth, we're at $1.8 billion.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Onstead, that is the way we generally, as legislature, do our fiscal impact notes, is using the inflation factor in there. So we would be using the 1.8 if we continued. I didn't point out, and I should, on the very back of your chart, it shows the estimated, it adds in lieu of that we'd have to pay, it adds the specials that would have on mobile home, because the mobile home tax is gone, and we'd have to cover that. But it also takes off the bond and indebtedness that would continue, and there's $812 million, if you have any questions on that. But go ahead.
Continue.
So, just to follow up on that, if our current budget is around $4 billion, so really what we're saying, that would be replaced, what, it would take half of that just for us to break even.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mount said you're good at math. That is true. It's $1.8 billion is what it is.
Okay, and so one last question. You mentioned all these different sections in code. Some are, how many sections of code will we really have to change in our current status? Do we have a number how enormous a task that would be and why we would require a special session?
Representative Wallstead's trying to decide if he should retire before that happened.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Onstead, I don't have an answer. I don't know if Mr. Knudsen would have an answer to that. It would take a lot of, you are correct, though. There's a lot of codes that have to be. And also the questions on how are we going to allow cities and counties and political subdivisions and schools to do their construction costs or improvement costs. And right now they're all at the discretion of the legislature and its funding.
Yes, Representative Kelch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Drubdahl, I'm not certain I understand where they're saying the savings of almost 12,000 employees would come from. They're calling them state employees or government employees. Most of those basically from the county, is that your understanding? Or are they considering statewide employees also, or state employees also?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Kelch, in reading the Beacon Hill study, and I certainly encourage you to do that, it's state employees because the county employees, they did report that there would be about a $25 million savings a year if we could eliminate the assessors and the billing procedures for property tax, but the committee came to the conclusion that that really wouldn't be possible, and may be able to reduce it somewhat, but there'd still need to be assessing and billing to continue to go out.
Thank you.
I just was asking the question, and I thought I had the right answer, but we already put $385 million of biennium into property tax relief, and that number is on top of the 812. It's not included in the 812, so you need to understand that real number is a billion. Even though we've already spent the $192 million a year, it's really, the 800 becomes a billion if you're looking at actual property tax dollars. So you need to understand, and I started thinking, is it in it or not in it? Well, it's not in it. It's on top of it.
That's correct, and it'd be $2.1 billion if you figured that in for the biennium.
Yep. Yes, Representative Damshin.
Mr. Chairman, and I'm not sure if this is for you, Ms. Representative Drubdahl, or you guys, but I'm just wondering, is there anything that prohibits counties or any political subdivision that is in debt and bonded for it from just abandoning it once this measure passes and saying, well, we're going to let the state pay that, going to submit that with our budget?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Damshin, if a city has agreed to bond and contracted with a individual of our company to buy that bond based on property tax assessment, that's a contractual agreement, and they would be required by law to continue to issue that property, to collect that property tax until that bond is paid off. There is a discrepancy in leasing agreements that some of the city and county, and I skipped over that, I didn't mean to. We have some political subdivisions who have leased a building for whatever amount, could be a dollar, could be $100 million a year, and at the end of a certain term, they would acquire that building for a dollar. That is being paid by general property tax. Now, if that political subdivision is currently or was in that agreement before the January 1st of this year, that would be included in the property tax. The state is going to pay for that political subdivision. If their neighbor had got a bond and bought that same building and was paying it back with a bond, they would be required to keep collecting the local level and pay back. So there's a discussion in that also.
Any other questions? Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you'd clarify for me, what did you mean when you said that the coal severance and conversion taxes are paid under protest? Would that jeopardize their in lieu of status, or what was that comment that you made?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Myers, when somebody owes taxes as a tax bill due and they don't feel they owe it, they pay it under protest. And that gives them the right to go back later on and challenge that tax. So when they pay it under protest, my own layman's mind says that they're thinking about challenging the court whether that tax stays in place.
Any other comments? Senator Hogan.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Chairman, I had a court out here for the first guy that called me Mr. Speaker, and he just won it.
Notice he's going to take it, too. Yeah, it should be that normal guy giving him a buck.
I've never been accused of being normal, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Skip, can you tell me, you talked about this special session, and I'm interested in knowing what would that special session look like? I mean, did your committee discuss, would we be taking testimony from these 300 or 400 political subdivisions? Would we be, would it just be the two appropriations committees meeting? And if you concluded that there's a special session required, how come we don't have that as part of the fiscal note?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, the only one I can call a special session would be the governor. And he would limit it to what we would be able to accomplish in there. If he wanted to, for us to start going through the budgets and audit them so that we treat everybody equally, which the state has to do, do a blanket funding, that would be entirely up to the governor how much of that special session, how much work he wanted that special session to do. Personally, I think myself, I can only answer for myself, I think it would be a relatively short one, basically appropriating the money required so that they could continue on, and then the legislature would have to go into a full audit mode during a regular session. Probably, in fact, my own opinion is that you are not going to be doing this as a part-time biannual legislature, but that is just my own personal opinion.
But I think the assumption is that when you read the measure, at least the way I read it, and maybe Mr. Walstead will have a different opinion, but it basically says our responsibility would be to fund what they were funded in 11. So you'd be giving them the same amount of money that they were getting. And it says they have the discretion to spend that money as they so see fit. So you could wash your hands of this whole thing if you read it in its simplest form and say, I'm going to give you the same amount of money, the $812 million or billion dollars is going out, $812 million, And you guys, that's what you got last time, that's what you get this time. And you could, at least if you went in the simplest form, Mr. Walston, any comment on that?
I agree.
Okay. So, I mean, it could be a very lengthy session, it could be a very short session. The question would be, what happens when everything needs to increase, or if something comes along where more money is required? That would be your biggest issue, I think.
Mr. Chairman, that's true, and also that the term legally funded obligation, full and proper of legal obligations, what's going to be new, and then the definite, then the thing that we're aware of because of school is equity in funding amongst the cities and towns. Are we going to fund a fire department with full staff employees in one town and just the trucks in another? Or, I mean, there's inequities within our cities and what they want to use their funds for, but if it comes from the state, are we going to be in a lawsuit over equity?
Well, those are questions I guess the voters will have to weigh out and decide for us. Again, we have to just make sure we stay on point here, that our job is to say that it's we believe the fiscal effect is $812 million. Right. Senator Lee, and then we'll move on.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Drovdahl, just to that point, if it actually is $1 billion, why aren't we including that rather than just 812? Yep. On the measure?
Well, we've already covered the other money.
But it's money, Mr. Chairman, that needs to be spent.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lee, the $812 million would be for current this biennium, where the 1.8 would be the next bienniums.
Understood, but
the year's half over.
The write-down that we're having to do, we're not including that in the measure, right?
No, it doesn't ask us to either. It's what they're currently assessing at their local level. And that is not counted because that's already coming from the state. It's kind of like our aid to schools. I mean, that's not counted in there already. The other 56% before we raised it to 70 wasn't counted. Senator Heckerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Drovdahl, I've heard it mentioned a couple of times today about the number of entities or political subdivisions at 300, and somewhere along the line when I've participated in some kind of forums, I understand that there are many others, and it may be in the range of 2,000 to 3,000. Is that what is the number that you've heard when you consider fire districts, park districts, and so forth? And then I have another question.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hickman, 357, the number 357 is the number of cities that the League of Cities reported were having a tax on. You are correct, there is also the counties above that. You also have the park boards above it. You also have the fire districts above it, and the other entities, townships are above it. I don't think we ever did actually ask the number, because our goal was mainly the property tax dollars that were coming into all of these entities, but it would be considerably above 357.
May I continue?
Continue.
Thank you. My other question has to do with, there's been some suggestion of doubling property tax or whatever. Did your committee discuss any other funding options? And to me, some of those may cause a domino effect, as if you remove $2 million from some fund that's already being used, what happens to that fund and how this could domino into other funding sources that we provide to the legislature?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Heckman, we did not feel it was our duty to start putting in place how to replace this, because it's not passed yet. Like the Attorney General, you don't rule on law until it's a law. And it would be up to the complete legislature to make that decision, and we were not instructed to start the process on that particular area, but it would be something that would have to be.
I mean, this is a hard issue because there's so many what-ifs. But I guess we really need to keep coming back to the point of, in his committee's estimation after the meeting, they believe the fiscal effect on an annual basis is $812,225,000.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Wardner.
I move we adopt this report.
It's our responsibility, by the way, committee, to adopt reports when a committee is required to give it to us, so I need a second. Second by Senator Heckerman. And we'll take a roll call vote on accepting the report.
Representatives Carlson.
Yes.
Damshin.
Aye.
Drovdahl.
Yes.
Kilsch.
Yes.
Meyer.
Yes.
Onstead.
Yes.
Ruby.
Yes.
Vigasaw.
Yes.
Senators Herbaly.
Yes.
Heckerman.
Yes.
Hoag?
Yes.
Lee?
Yes.
Robinson?
Aye.
Taylor?
Aye.
Wardner?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman, the motion carries.
All right, we have the, is there someone here from the tax department for their agreement or disagreement or whatever on the fiscal impact of the issue? Again, this, I know this is really hard to stay on point here on the number, because we all have opinions about the value or not value of this measure, but we're going to really try and stay on what is the number.
Good morning, Chairman, members of the Legislative Management Committee.
You got to push the button. There you go.
For the record, I'm Catherine Strombeck, Research Analyst with the Office of Tax Commissioner, and a lot of what I have to say is just going to probably reiterate on some of the things that Chairman Drubdahl covered. I believe you all have a copy of the fiscal note. Was it in your packet? If not, I think it was. Yep. Yeah, okay, yeah. So you actually have the fiscal note that we provided to the committee. All the assumptions that we used in compiling the fiscal note are consistent with Mr. Wallstedt's memo that he prepared last fall responding to many, many questions that legislators had about the measure. So the opinions that Mr. Wallstedt offered were the basis of the assumptions in our fiscal note. The biggest component of the fiscal note is the general ad valorem property tax component at just under $830 million. This is our estimate of what our basic residential, agriculture, and commercial and centrally assessed property tax would be in 2012, payable in 2013. So that's the biggest component. We follow just a linear trend with what's the recent history. It's roughly 7.7% per year, just a straight line linear trend in arriving at that $830 million. From this, we added, or to this, we added the in lieu of taxes that are based on property valuations. These include National Guard land, state game and fish land. I believe Representative Drubdahl covered all of these. Land acquired by the Water Commission, some school lands, some nonprofits for conservation purposes. These in lieu of taxes are in place of property taxes, but because they're based on value, on property value, they act exactly like ad valorem taxes, and the assumption is that they would go away if the measure is successful. In lieu of taxes that are not based on property values are assumed to stay in place, and these are things like oil and gas gross production, with all due respect, not oil extraction tax, coal conversion tax, but not coal severance tax, telecommunications gross receipts tax, electrical generation distribution and transmission taxes. Those are all in lieu of property taxes that are assumed to stay in place because they're not based on value. To this number, we added the special taxes on mobile homes. Mobile homes are actually not subject to a property tax, they're subject to a special tax, but it works like a property tax. We assume it would go away with the successful passage of the measure. And from that total, then, we subtracted the bond repayments. As Representative Drubdahl said, we have a number of these. Actually, there are seven separate levies for bond repayments, two for schools, two for cities, one for counties, one for townships, and one for parks. 62 political subdivisions levied for these bond repayments in 2010. So therefore, those 62, and perhaps some that came on in 2011, at least those 62 political subdivisions will continue to impose an ad valorem property tax into the future for the length of that bond repayment. So all this equates to the $812 million. It is a one-year fiscal note, basically, because it's the only year that impacts the 2011-2013 biennium. And then, as you all talked, it grows to something about $1.8 billion in the following biennium when there's 2 years affected. So even though we provided you some growth here, roughly 7.7%, the opinion, according to Mr. Wallstedt, is that perhaps it is the 2011 number that binds you in terms of total legally imposed obligations. So, you know, we're not superimposing that the assumption that you have to grow your replacement dollars so much as this is what general ad valorem property taxes would likely have grown. They go away with the successful passage of the measure, and that's our best estimate of what would go away, if that makes sense. So there's a little bit difference there.
So you're in agreement with the number?
Absolutely, is our number.
Senator Wardner?
Mr. Chairman and Catherine, you're saying that $1.8 billion would be the next biennium?
Mr. Mr. Chairman, Senator Warner, that's exactly right. An estimate for the following biennium when you have 2 years' worth of property taxes that are not being collected.
In your opinion, if the legislature says we're not going anymore, or we aren't going to go that much, we have that authority, won't we, in the future? I mean, we don't, there is no percentage in there that says we have to use for the inflationary factor, do we?
No, you're absolutely correct, there is no. It's our assumption of what the linear trend line would be if property taxes stayed in place. But depending on your actions as a legislative body and perhaps what the court rules, you may be able to fix it at that prior 2011 number. That's true. There's no requirement that you grow at any inflationary factor.
I can tell you that 7.7% is the reason that issue's on the ballot. When you look at that kind of growth over all those years, there's a reason why it's here. It's just whether it's the right tool or not, and we're trying to assess the number. But I can tell you my biased perspective is if you look at that into the next 10 years, you'd say, wow, where's it going to be at? Anything else, Catherine?
Just one comment on that, Mr. Chairman. It was brought to my attention over the weekend that at 7.7%, in fact, that doubles in a decade or something, 6% of that 7% is new properties coming online. So it is not a situation where any given household necessarily is going to find its taxes doubling. And it's the current phenomena right now. We are in absolute record growth in our state, as we all know, both population, properties coming online, all those things are, you know, surfacing right now. The trend of property taxes absolutely is probably the reason why this measure is before us. But that alone, on any given parcel, that growth is not 7%.
Averages are always scary things.
Right.
Because in a lot of the rural communities, there's no way that that would be the number. And in there's growth communities, and there are those that are not.
Right.
But overall, that number, when you average it out, gets people's attention. Senator Warner?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Kathy, then does that, with that information you just gave, 6% of the 7.7% is new properties, that would mean that it's growing at about 1.7%? Is that approximate?
That's fair. And this was a very quick little analysis done by a member of our property tax staff that we haven't had a chance to really vet. We just said, quickly, can you tell us new properties? So she went to the abstracts and said, looks like new properties are growing about 6%. So, yes.
Well, then what we should be doing is talking about 1% to 7% growth, because everybody likes an increase, and the growth is always good. People don't mind
absolutely
new property coming online and paying taxes.
Of the 7.7%, a lot of this is good news.
It'd be a lot, it'd be a lot better way to explain it than the 7.7 overall for everybody, because that's what really gets people excited. Anything else for yes, Mr. Ruby, Reverend Ruby?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stromberg, in our committee, the taxation committee, of course, there was a lot of discussion about what's it going to generate and the economic activity, and Senator Cook was correct in stating that many of the bills that come before the legislative session that reduce income tax or anything like that, generally it's the tax department brings in what the reduction of that tax is without an estimate of what that revenue would create as far as economically. And so I understand that, and I accept that and accept what your numbers are. But the other thing that the tax department, your department deals with is income tax, of course, and your property tax is deducted on your income tax. So couldn't your office have estimated what increase in income tax people would have paid by not having that deduction, and what that amount of increase of tax that people were going to be paying on that side of it would have offset the loss of I guess it would have offset what we had to replace for the property tax.
I'd rather just leave it later.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ruby, it actually works probably in the opposite way. It means additional income tax that people are going to have to pay by losing that deductibility. The state has among the lowest income taxes in the nation. The bigger consequence is clearly the federal consequence. It's money that North Dakotans will be paying to the federal government by losing that property tax deductibility.
I understand that, but I'm just wondering about from the state side of it.
Right, and we can certainly do some work on that, and we'd be happy to do that.
There would be some fiscal effect, but it wouldn't be as major as the Fed by any means.
Right.
I understand, right. Yeah, I realize.
You know, our top rate is 3.99%. The top federal rate is 39%. So, you know,
But you take the overall $812 million and, you know...
There will be a little positive income tax consequence, without a doubt.
Right.
Right about that.
Is there a possibility to get that number provided to the committee?
Absolutely, we can. I don't know.
Okay.
Meeting again.
Thank you.
See you.
Any other comments, questions for Ms. Strombeck? Thank you very much. Mr. Walsted, would you come to the podium, please? Yes, Representative Kelch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, out in our area, we've had quite a few meetings on Measure 2, and your comment about, you know, the increase in property taxes over the next 10 years is a minor factor in those, but the major factor is that they're not assessed probably evenly, and across all areas they see corporations that get property tax relief for 5-10 years. Then they see that the legislature is passing income tax breaks to those same people, and not that I'm saying some of that's all wrong, but I didn't agree with those tax breaks in the last session. But they're seeing, as a household or the farmer, that they're paying taxes, and a lot of other people that maybe can afford them more aren't paying taxes. That's what I'm hearing out there, is the unfairness of the collecting of them. Why are we giving out-of-state corporations income tax breaks, and we're paying more property tax? It doesn't make any sense to those folks. And the thing that I've heard at every meeting I've been to is that we hope it doesn't pass, but we sure as the heck hope that the legislature gets a little scared over the possibility of it passing and does something about it, because if they don't, there will be another measure that will pass. And that's what I'm hearing. Thank you.
Walsted. Any comments as the chief staff that worked on this, legal counsel that worked on the issue? Did we cover all the aspects? I think we have a pretty good understanding of the process. But I have one major question, and that's about special assessments. Can they be used as a taxing method when the real estate tax goes away? Could they use that as a funding source for other programs and within a political subdivision?
Mr. Chairman, not as current law exists. Special assessments are allowed to be levied for listed purposes. I think for cities there are 5 things on the list. None of those are general government functions or anything like that, so it couldn't be used for budget supplementation unless the legislature made some serious changes in the statutory provisions. That could be done under the measure, but it would change the basis of who pays for what from value of property to the deemed benefit to property, which is how special assessments are levied.
So there's no concern there about that being abused? You take away one side and then it grows on the other side. That, because of the intended uses, that can't happen. You take away the general property tax, the special assessments can be used to infill what they need to for increases.
Not under current law.
Okay.
Yes.
Anything else? General comments about the whole process and the explanation we received? Anything get missed?
No. I believe Mr. Speaker did a very good job of explaining.
He's looking for his quarter, by the way, Doug.
That's okay. I believe he did a very good job of explaining what was obviously a lot of discussion and information received and considered by the committee. And as you said, there are a lot of question marks here, things we don't really know the answers to. There will probably be some court decisions, but even more there will be, if the measure passes, a lot of legislative decisions and interpretations of how do we read the measure, how do we view legislative responsibility, how do we view fully and properly funding
obligations of political subdivisions.
And some of the language was a little bit vague. I'm trying to look at the one now about reasonable or, I just, fully and properly fund the legally imposed obligations. That fully mean that, that could be one of those things that gets you going.
Well, true, but it's fully and properly. To me, properly, that's a judgment call.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm deciding how much allowance my kids should get, fully and properly is what I think it should be, not what they think it should be.
Interesting language. Representative Vigasau.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Walsted, was there any discussion about those that pay in lieu of property taxes? Those taxes, would they be challenged in any way if property taxes go away and the tax that they're paying in lieu of property taxes would be a subject for discussion?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Vigasau, as the speaker mentioned, in lieu of taxes, some I think would clearly go away, some I think would clearly not go away. The ones that are based on assessment of property to determine what the tax is, I believe those would go away. The oil and gas gross production tax, it's an in lieu of property tax, but it's not based on assessment of property. It's more of an excise tax. It's based on the value of oil or gas when it's pulled out of the wellhead. So that would not go away. The next part of the question about would there be some legal challenges? Probably. Rural electric cooperatives, I think, would be at the courthouse door in a hurry. The whole playing field for them would change because they do not pay property tax. They pay other kinds of taxes, none of which are based on assessed value of the property they operate.
Any other questions for Mr. Walsted? Yes, Representative Damshin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe Mr. Walsted could get into the economics of what Representative Kelch mentioned. Under the current system, a tax break is given to, say, a corporation and they establish a business. Does that not raise the tax base of the political subdivision where that takes place and probably generate a lot more property tax down the road from that entity?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Demption, that has been the traditional view of why it's appropriate to provide those kinds of incentives, that ultimately there will be growth in the tax base, which ultimately will take some pressure off the other property taxpayers. Oddly enough, if the measure becomes effective and eliminates property tax during the period of that exemption, then that property got a benefit and the rest of the people in that district will never see the benefit of the property tax that would have been received down the road from it. So, I mean, there are different situations all over. There will be unique effects for certain kinds of property and certain political subdivisions, and it changes the game. A lot of adjustments will have to be made locally and at the state level.
Thank you very much. Representative Drubdahl, Speaker Drubdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I we always get in trouble when you recognize people, and I did recognize two deserving people that Ms. Killer and Mr. Knutson for all the work they did for the committee, and I overlooked Mr. Walsted. He did a lot of work in answering 30-40 questions that we had come up with, and his opinion, of course, is what we have to rely our results on, and unless they're challenged in court. But he did a lot of work for us. He did a great job, and we do thank you. Appreciate your work.
Pleasure.
Sure. Anything else, Mr. Walsted?
Well, a question was raised earlier about the number of sections of law that would have to be addressed by the legislature.
I have been putting together a bill draft as such. Thus far, I have identified 540-some sections that would have to be amended.
Wow.
200 or 300 that would have to be repealed. And I haven't even begun to try and figure out how many sections would have to be created. So...
Remember when you told me don't ever eliminate mills?
Oh, yeah.
I still think that's outdated, but he told me it would take a lifetime to get them all out of code.
Yeah, well, that's a big part of that 540.
You bet. Senator Taylor?
Mr. Chairman, John, just a question on the number that would be used on that fully funding. You know, when we talk about the inflationary, whether the 7.7% is accurate, or if it's justifiable under the initiative. If you were to take that to court, you'd almost have to wait for the legislature to come in and fund it at the 812 or the 774 before they would have standing to say, no, this is not what the statute read. And I mean, would there be standing to go to court before the legislature in special session even came to more properly define that? You actually have to wait for them, wouldn't you?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Taylor, I think you're right. And there are a lot of things that would be pending, but before one of them can happen, something else would. So the dominoes have to be in the right order, but I think you're right that if the legislature decided full and proper funding is this many dollars and here's how it will be allocated, then I think political subdivisions could take court action and challenge that interpretation. But prior to the legislature taking that step, I don't believe the court would open the door.
That makes sense when you think about it.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Walston.
First move will be the legislature's.
In my opinion, the first move is June 12th.
Well, that, yeah.
Then we'll see what happens.
After that one.
Thank you for your work on the issue. Is there anyone here that has any comments about the fiscal impact from the public? Anybody wants to make a comment? All right. Ms. Sharp?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Pam Sharp with the Office of Management and Budget. And I wasn't here for the discussion, but it was just brought to my attention that there was a question about Beacon Hill's statement or assumption about 11,000 FTEs being removed or not being necessary. State government in itself has slightly less than 8,000 FTEs. In our appropriations book, when we list all the FTEs, it's a little more than 11,000, but about 3,000 of those are higher ed's general fund FTEs. So if we just look at state government itself, a little less than 8,000 FTEs.
And we don't have any idea how many are out in the counties. I think they were assuming that a lot of those would be out in the counties.
I don't have that count. I just have the state.
Obviously, they got it, a number from someplace. I'm assuming that they did, but that probably has to get rid of everybody.
Thank you.
All right. Anybody else from the public? Kathy, have you got another comment for us?
Chairman, I have a number here. In Commissioner Fong's binder, he had some of the research we had done earlier on this issue, so thank you to Corey. Relative to Representative Ruby's question, this is a question regarding the deductibility of property taxes. The loss of property taxes would mean $38 million in federal taxes, additional federal taxes, and an estimated $5 million in additional state taxes. And the difference there, of course, being the difference of rates. Yep. But that's assuming the same level of itemized deductions that currently happen. That is actually trending downward a bit. As the standard deduction grows, fewer people itemize. So this might be slightly on the high side, but this estimate was $38 million in federal taxes per year and $5 million in state income taxes per year.
So. Representative Onstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that same note, if that deduction is eliminated, then would there be any part of the fiscal impact come back to cost of goods?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Onstead, yes, that's entirely possible, and I think we've kind of touched on that. And when we do fiscal notes, anytime there's any significant rate increase or decrease, that's expenditures not available for other things. And certainly with the property tax, depending on if there's a tax shift, it's basically potentially a wash, if it's an actual elimination, there may be some additional taxes. We generally do a static approach on our fiscal notes. States that have gone down that path of trying to determine the multiplier effect of rate reductions or increases generally find themselves in budget problems real quickly. And so our state has avoided that, luckily. So it does seem to work better to do the static. What is the real first line cost of a tax increase or benefit of a tax decrease? And so we start and stop our fiscal notes there, and then I know that's probably frustrating, but it does make for a slightly more pure picture when you're doing your revenue forecasting and your budgeting.
Always easier to balance your budget when you overestimate your revenue.
There is that too.
We get criticized all the time about the legislature's too conservative in our estimates, and we hire pretty good accounting and pretty good forecasters, and we use their numbers, and if they're low, that's good. That means things went well here. But it sure be easier to take it on the other side to justify your spending, so we've got to always keep that in mind. Any other comments, anybody from the public? Again, we're looking just to verify that number of $812,225,000. If not, we'll move on to the next issue. It's a presentation by OMB regarding the estimated fiscal impact of the initiated measure that would prohibit government from burdening the exercise of religious liberty. Is there someone here from family going to take that? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, again, for the record, Pam Sharp, OMB, and this will be very short because we at OMB were unable to determine what the fiscal impact would be, if any, of Measure 3. We're just totally unable to determine that.
Measure 3 had to do with, I don't know if I have that, do we have that in front of us? It's in the packet. And government may not burden a person or persons or religious organizations with religious liberty. The right to act or refuse an act in manner motivated by a sincerely held religious belief may not be burdened unless the government proves it has a compelling governmental interest in infringing the specific act or refusal to act and has used the least restrictive means to further that interest. The burden includes indirect burdens such as withholding benefits, assessing penalties, or an exclusion of programs or access to facilities. And I can understand why it would have been very difficult for you to come up with a number on that. So your comment would be that there would be zero impact, unable to determine any impact.
Mr. Chairman, unable to determine what, if any, it would be.
Okay. Any questions, committee members? Senator Heckerman?
Mr. Chairman, tell me what that means.
Tell you what means.
This measure. Tell me what that means so I can explain to my constituents.
Well, I think there's someone here from that side. I'll let him explain
okay,
it because I'm not sure that I can do it.
Thank you.
Any other comments? Yes, Representative Monstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Pam, you say there's no recognizable, but it's been brought up that parts of this might be conflict with how things are currently done in the courts and dealing with juries and arrests and so on and is that something that's not able to determine?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yeah, I'm not saying that there's clearly no impact at all. I'm just saying we're unable to determine what, if any, it would be. We can't quantify anything.
Yes, Representative Kelch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This isn't, it mentioned somebody's here to explain what it means, but I'm hoping that in that explanation, there's an explanation of the possible ramifications of this if it was passed, because I don't know. I mean, it's pretty vague, and there's some things out there that may be a little scary.
Any other comments? Mr. Fryer, do you have any comments? Could you respond to the question we had here to see if you could answer that for us?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I would be happy to. In regard to the fiscal ramifications, I really didn't believe that there were any. I think we used some legal folks in the drafting of this measure, and I didn't hear one of those folks indicating that we should be concerned about any sort of fiscal ramifications of it. just don't know how that could take place. Obviously, some folks could come up with some hypotheticals, but without knowing what those hypotheticals were, I just wouldn't be able to respond to that.
So what would, I'm reading here that we had some work done by our staff, and I'm going to read a comment, and you tell me if you believe that that is correct about the proponents of the measure contend that the measure restores protections to religious liberty that were in place before the 1990 United States Supreme Court decision. They argue that the court decision removed the requirement that the government show a compelling governmental interest to justify a challenged law that infringes on religious liberty, and that as a result of that case, the general law applies to everyone, even if the law inadvertently infringes on an individual's religious freedom.
Yeah, I think
would you say that's a pretty good description of it?
A pretty good description.
I think I agree with Senator Heckman. I think it's very hard to explain, even though we might be in agreement with him. If someone asked me to describe what it is, I'd be hard pressed.
If I have the podium, I'd be happy to do it.
Well, just give us what you believe that's correct. And
the historical what happened in 1990 was that a Supreme Court remove something that's called the compelling interest test. And what the compelling interest test is really that there is a good reason that a government entity, and this is not one person to another, this is a government entity at that time, whether it was federal, state, city, county, whatever the government entity was that wished to infringe upon someone's sincerely held religious belief, that they needed to have a good reason. This particular court case in 1990 removed what was called the compelling interest test and made it very open, wide, and the availability of just about any government entity to do that and not have that compelling interest. As you see in the language of the measure, it basically just restores what the Supreme Court removed in 1990, which consequently in 1993, the federal government through Congress passed a bill to restore that very same compelling interest test, and another court shortly after that said, you can't do that for the states. They have to do that for themselves. And so there is a federal Religious Freedom Act signed by then President Clinton, and having wide support from just 200 different entities, all the way from the ALCU to the Southern Baptist Convention, and it was put back in for the federal government. And subsequently, about 25 states, some statutorily, one constitutionally, have put measures back in their codes. Some, as a result of some court decisions, have come up with precedents that are used for the very same thing. So about half of the states today and the federal government have some of this very same wording right now. And so, you know, some of the folks that may be pointing towards some hypotheticals, I'd ask them to go look and see if those things are actually happening in those 25 states and in the federal government right now. That's kind of
Senator Heckman and then Representative Onstad.
Yep, yep.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Farrar, can you give me an example of how somebody in rural North Dakota would be using this? Give me a case or an example that you've covered, because I don't have a background in this. Appreciate that.
Well, the recent case, if you will, that is very easy to understand, it is on a federal level, but if something occurred like that in a state, it would work here too. And that is, of course, with the recent case where the HHS is attempting and is telling an organization, a religious organization, in this case it happens to be the Catholic organization, that they must provide abortifacient sterilization drugs or contraceptives. And that organization is saying, we don't want to do that because of our sincerely held religious belief. The administration is saying, you will do that. So their sincerely held religious belief is being abridged by a mandate from a government entity. And so if you will look around the country today, you'll see a lot of that going on. And if anything of that sort were to happen from any government authority toward either an individual or an organization, that's what this is attempting to protect.
Representative Onstad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The big difference is things are in statute in other states, and then this becomes a constitutional right. And so I think currently we have similar language as statute in Article 1, I believe, but now this is a constitutional right, and I guess, could you explain the difference when things are in statute, things go to court?
I don't know that we want to go there.
Okay.
I mean, it's not the fiscal part of this, and we could have this debate for a long time, but, and I don't mean to cut you off either, I just think it's, you know, you two can talk about that in the hall if you want, but as far as us, you believe there's no fiscal effect? Okay, we're going to leave it at that, otherwise we're going to get deep into this thing, I can smell it.
Thank you.
All right, there is no report to accept on this, is there?
Mr. Chairman, what you'd want to do is have a motion accepting the fiscal impact.
From OMB saying there is no...
That they can't determine the fiscal impact, and then we would forward that as part of our report to the Secretary of State on both measures.
Could I have a motion to that effect? I have a motion by Representative Drubdahl. Is there a second? I have a second by Representative Damshin. Any further discussion? Not, we'll take the roll.
Representatives Carlson?
Yes.
Damshin?
Aye.
Drubdahl?
Yes.
Kelsch?
Yes.
Meyer?
Yes.
Onstead?
Yes.
Ruby?
Yes.
Vigasaw?
Yes.
Senators Eberle?
Yes.
Heckerman?
Yes.
Hoag?
Yes.
Lee?
Aye.
Robinson?
Aye.
Taylor?
Aye.
Wardner?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman, the motion carries.
Mr. Speaker, do you have some comments to make?
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. In committee, I appreciate a couple of minutes of your time. Recently, within the last 2 weeks, I was invited, along with a couple of other House members, up to the province of Saskatchewan to visit with their Speaker and the Prime Minister and a number of their ministers. We had a very good discussion. We have some things much in common: oil and gas exploration, coal exploration, potash exploration, our highways. We have, of course, in common, we use our highways and we use theirs for commercial purposes. And our agriculture we have in common, although they don't have a wheat board, that we may be seeing more of them down here. They had a couple of requests that I couldn't grant. Of course, as a speaker, I couldn't say, we'll do this, we'll do that. But they had a couple of suggestions and requests. One had to do with CSG. They are associate members of Midwest CSG, and they asked if it would be possible that North Dakota sponsor them as full member in the Midwest CSG, not the National CSG.
What does that mean?
I did talk to the Midwest CSG. They said it is possible, and it pretty much is a decision of Saskatchewan's Parliament if they want to do that. I don't think it would take sponsorship, but it may take somebody making a motion to do it, would probably be about all. It, for them, it would increase, it would give them the right to vote at the Midwest Conference. It would increase their cost into the conference from about $18,000 to $40,000, and that would be their decision, of course. And my question is, if I am going to the Midwest Conference in Cleveland, if they ask me to make the motion, is that an objection by the state of North Dakota? Is they be asking me to do it as a speaker of the state of North Dakota? The other thing is that they're very interested in working with us on a regular basis, and they have gone down and with Montana and signed an accord with Montana that a delegation from Montana visits them during their parliamentary session, and they visit Montana. So they have a delegation appointed by the speaker, I believe, that visits Montana. They requested that we have that same accord, and only that they would come down the years that we meet, and we would have a delegation go to them in the years that we don't meet, otherwise even years. I did, by happen to have a Natural Resource Committee meeting the next day after I came back from that meeting, and a subject came up that was of beneficial interest to both Saskatchewan and North Dakota, and I did ask the Natural Resource Committee to consider recommending an accord, and they are going to get a copy of it just so that you're aware of it. It has been promoted both by Saskatchewan and their leadership. So Speaker Dumont did a great job of entertaining us, and if he comes down here, it's going to cost me a few dollars out of my pocket to entertain him is good, but it was an excellent meeting, and I think it's a great idea. I did visit with the governor, and he thought it was a great idea, and we as legislatures and them as legislatures, both as policy branch, have a little better
communications. We have good communications now, but it can never be too good. So I did want to report on those two things, and if there's any comments, I'd certainly like to listen to them. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think the second one, where we have an accord, would have to be required to be dealt with during the legislative session, but as far as us sponsoring them, it doesn't cost us anything. If they wanted to join, if they needed someone to say, yeah, we'd like them in, I don't know, I think we could have a motion of that here, and it wouldn't be a problem to do that. But as far as having an agreement, then I think we need to do that with the full legislature. Any comments, thoughts on that, Senator Robinson?
Mr. Chairman, based on the speaker's report, I think it would be a good move on our part, enhance communication and relations with the neighbors to the north. And if it'd be in order, I would move that we provide authorization to sponsor them to CSG.
Is there a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. I think we need to take a voice vote on that. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That would be, Mr. Speaker, you could pass that along and you to the CSG folks and to find out what's required there, because it's up to them to pay the dues if they're in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
NCSL, for example, it's kind of interesting. The only full member of NCSL is Ontario. And the other provinces have chosen not to do it, and they have become a very active trading partner in energy and hydropower and all kinds of other things, offshore oil that they have. But the other provinces have not shown much of an interest in getting involved in that process. So, and we obviously do have a lot in common with the Saskatchewan guys. So is there anything else for the good of the order? Representative Kelch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I have a question on when we hired an attorney to appear with the Attorney General in front of the Supreme Court. We didn't get much out of that. I read the brief. I don't know. I guess my first question is, how much did that cost us to have that attorney? The brief, I wasn't very excited about. I read the whole thing. I didn't think it did much other than state some talking points that had been, and I'm not an attorney, so I'm not sure what should have been done. But when I voted to do that, I thought they were going to ask that the constitutionality of this be determined, whether we should, can and should be monkeying in here. That didn't happen. If this thing passes on the primary, we're going to have to do that again. We're going to have to appear in front of the Supreme Court. We're going to have to maybe protect our interests if that's people think we so need to do that. But I was really disappointed in the whole process that we got nothing out of that other than go to the people. And I didn't think that was the reason that we were appearing there.
You see, we were there defending ourselves. On the contrary, I think they did a good job in the brief. I thought it was well done, and I think it defended the interests of the legislature, and I think we needed to be at the table. The Supreme Court opted not to address that issue. They opted to let it go. So that means it is coming back, and everything that we put into use can be used again, in my opinion, as far as the constitutionality. So I think it was very imperative that we were at the table. And
Mr. Chairman, did we ask that they determine the constitutionality, or did we just let them determine it?
Well, they decided, they had the balls in their court. We defended what we felt were the interests and why we as a legislature had authority. If you read the brief, it said why we believe we have the authority to make those kind of decisions, and that the Constitution clearly says constitutional and legislative limitations. The brief was well done. I don't think anybody gets much out of the remarks if anybody went to listen to those. But the Supreme Court had the call, and they called. Their decision was let the people vote, and the Attorney General and the Board of Higher Ed already said they're coming back if they lose. So I don't think any of this was wasted. I think it'll be well used in the future. Representative Ruby?
Mr. Chairman, I have a different question. As far as the Property Tax Review Committee, are we done until the end of the vote? Or, as Mr. Walstead said, he's been working on a draft. Is that something that the committee should be reviewing? I wasn't sure when you created that committee. I thought we were going to be looking at doing some definitions of those terms that you said are pretty vague. Initially, we requested the Attorney General help us with that. He sort of punted that until it passes. So I guess I thought that was something the committee was going to be working on. The members of the committee would verify that I requested that we work on those and start to maybe clear up some of those gray areas with that committee, since we had all the partners of the cities, the counties, the townships, everybody was basically at the meetings. I thought that was the time to start working on those and developing it, just in the case that it does pass. But the decision, I guess, was made by Chairman Drevdahl that we don't waste the time on it until it passes. But we could be scrambling if it does pass. And I guess hearing that Mr. Walstead already has some draft legislation, wouldn't it be proper for that committee to start reviewing and going through some of that?
Well, my original intent on the committee when we set it up was just to find out what the fiscal effect was. And I think that I would prefer that you waited until it was over to do any further work. I don't think any one of us, Representative Ruby, believes that this issue of property tax reform is going away, no matter what the end result is of measure number two. And I think I would prefer that we've got the number, we let it go forward, let the people decide, and then we do the work. And we also have another tax committee that's in place. There's going to be a lot that needs to be done if it passes.
Mr. Chairman, couldn't we have just requested a fiscal note from the tax department, just like we just did with Measure 3?
Well, we could have done that, obviously, but then we always say, was that a slanted or not? Was there legislative input? Was there the people directly involved, more eyes looking at it? I always like our committees to be engaged in those things instead of just relying. And we've had criticism before that if someone doesn't like it, it dies by death of a fiscal note. And my opinion was, from Representative Drevdahl, that your committee voted rather unanimously to accept that as a number.
Yeah.
So because of that, I believe we had better eyes looking at it. Okay. Yes, Representative Kelch.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd ask the question, how much did that attorney cost, and didn't get an answer to it?
The answer was about $32,000.
Thank you.
Yep. There's some odd pennies in there, but that's about the number.
Senator Taylor?
Okay. Any other comments, questions? Representative Kelch, anything else? It's close.
I've got a lot to say, but I'm not
going to say it. Adjourned.
Vouchers, yeah, there probably are somewhere. Yeah, this was a donated one, didn't they tell you that?
Where'd those go?
Yep. Oops. Should be it. Then we got these in the middle there.
I was wondering if it was going to be a fiscal vote on this.